This is The Point. I'm Heather Goldstone. Literature sometimes reflects public sentiments. Other times, it shapes them. Today, we'll explore how scientists have been portrayed in fiction writing. This isn't science fiction, although there will inevitably be some overlap. What we're talking about today is novels that have scientists as main characters. With me is Melanie Lowers, book editor at the Cape Cod Times, and Jill Erickson, reference librarian at Falmouth Public Library. Welcome to both of you.
Good morning.
Thank you, Heather.
All right, so part of this came out of this lab lit group that's just getting started at Falmouth Public Library, a reading group. But this is not just Falmouth Public Library. There's a whole lab lit movement.
That is correct. What we discovered when we started looking into this was that there is, in fact, a very big lab lit movement. And we started this because we, as a town, were reading Frankenstein. And because we were reading Frankenstein, we decided we wanted to read that with our fiction book group that we have at the library. But what we do with our fiction book group is we generally pick six books for 6 months so that we don't have to be every month picking a book. Well, so we knew we had to start with Frankenstein. So if we were starting with Frankenstein, where are we going to go from there? And we had various ideas about which direction we could take. Although what ended up happening was, in fact, I discovered this thing called Lablet, which I didn't know existed prior to looking for books to read with Frankenstein. And basically what Lablet is, as you said, were books, novels that have to do with real science and real scientists. And so it begins sort of with the idea of Frankenstein as the mad scientist, which we'll talk a little bit about. But then it moves on from there. And there I discovered this article written by a woman who has an entire website called Lablet.
Her name is Jennifer Wright.
God bless her for it. It's a helpful thing.
It is.
The article was written by Jennifer Roan, who runs the Lablet site. And what she was noticing, this was an article she wrote in 2010 for Nature magazine, a scientific magazine. And she was asking why so many novels with scientists as central characters had been published that year in 2010. And her question was, is this increased attention to science and fiction a recent phenomena? And if so, what is driving it? Across the tens of thousands of novels published each year, it is difficult to measure how often science crops up as a theme. A subgenre is easier to track, namely lablet. I coined the term in 2001 to describe realistic novels that contain scientists as central characters plying their trade. It's distinct from science fiction, in which the action takes place in speculative worlds and may not involve scientist characters, but I would say generally does.
Yes.
And one of the things we've been trying to figure out as we've prepared for this show is how broadly do we look at this?
Right. I mean, she's kind of referring to it as a genre, but you were both saying before that this isn't really a genre. This is trying to find books based on one character, a character type. I mean, how much of a challenge was it? You've both got pretty substantial piles here.
Well, but you know what? It started with in one place, which was Lablet. Actually, Google. I went on Google and I Googled scientists in fiction, and Lablet popped up. So I said, well, gee, okay. So I went in and she had some lists. But so that was my starting point. You know, what is she including? And then as I saw some things I was very surprised about, for example, a Steinbeck was on the list. And I was like, Steinbeck, where does that come from? Well, as I started to do the research, I realized that that this is older than we think, first of all.
And scientists crop up everywhere.
They do. They crop up everywhere, but sometimes we just don't pay attention. And we just don't pay attention, for example, we were saying earlier about, you know, mailmen. If we went out to look for mailmen, there are the postman rings, always rings twice. The mailmen are out there, but there's no shelf for them. And we're used to picking like whole, areas like let's do environment, let's do animals, let's do this. So those shelves are there. But for a particular sort of aspect of human endeavor, that's a little bit harder to find. But in terms of the Steinbeck, and I was very, very surprised to see this, This was written in 1945, Cannery Row, and it's a classic. Mm-hmm. It probably doesn't get written or read as much as it used to, but it's still out there. It's still part of the major works of his. There's a character named Doc, and Doc is based on marine biologist Ed Ricketts, who was a friend of Steinbeck's, a really good friend of Steinbeck's. And in this group of people who live in Monterey, and it's all canneries and things like that, it's a rough section of town. They're fishermen, and there are people who cut up fish, and there's prostitutes and bar owners and the local, you know, what we would call the convenience store, but the little local shop order and stuff. There's Doc, who is actually looking at the town and the fisheries in a totally different way. He's there literally as a biologist looking at the quality of the fish, where they're coming from, in what numbers, that kind of thing. But he fits right into the stream of the town anyway. And Steinbeck must have felt, you know, pretty strongly that his friend Ed Ricketts was the same way, that Ed was interested in marine biology, but in the final analysis, he was just a regular guy, you know, that you could sit down and have a talk with, even though his knowledge of fish would have been, you know, a lot stronger. And you write in the introduction here, the marine biologist Edward F. Ricketts was Steinbeck's closest friend for 18 years, from 1930, when they met shortly after Steinbeck moved to Pacific Grove, to 1948, when Ricketts died after his car was struck by a train. Ricketts was an exceptional man, quote, different from anyone, and yet so like that everyone found himself in Ed. As Steinbeck describes him in a biographical tribute about Ed Ricketts that serves as a preface for the Log from the Sea of Cortez, Ricketts was a man whose mind had no horizons. He was interested in everything. Ed never moralized in any way. He would be more likely to examine the problem carefully with calm and clarity, and to lift the horrors out of it by easy examination. So he's working the scientific method in life. And Steinbeck realizes this and recognizes it and appreciates it. And so when he's looking for all these different kinds of people who converge in this area that really most people don't want to go to, you know, it's kind of the low end of town, he includes Doc in there as a person who would naturally be in that place, but is doing very different work.
Yeah, it's interesting. He doesn't just have his name, he's Doc. And I think Doc, that's, right. You know, that's a, well, whether it's Doc in Back to the Future, or, you know, I think that's something
Doc
that
and Gilligan's Island.
Actually, he's cropped up time and time again, is that we set the scientist apart, right?
Right.
We call him Doc. They've got this kind of overarching, you can call any of these characters Doc.
Doc, right.
Absolutely. One of the other things in this article about that she wrote about this Lablet, she talks about why maybe this is happening now. And she says, rather than reflecting society's hopes and fears about technology, as science fiction does, Lablet tends to focus on the intricacies of scientific work and scientists as people. Writers might be responding to social trends that have made science and technology more palatable, encouraged by a geek chic movement and the attention devoted to sci art collaborations. Or a critical mass of well-known authors penning Lablet might have inspired others to try. Around the time of the upturn, established literary figures such as William Boyd, Neal Stephenson, Richard Powers, Jonathan Lethem, and Simon Maurer published novels about scientists for the first time, which may have influenced other authors and publishers, because, of course, once a publisher sees that something sells, there will be more of it. It doesn't matter what it is, there will be more of it. And I think that that is also, much of this is in response because, as you were saying, this is it's career fiction. You know, it could be, again, any career. But because this sort of backlash towards the mad scientist of Frankenstein is so strong, that is one of the reasons it continues to sort of flourish. And Frankenstein is a great novel, may I just say, if you've never read it, you should certainly look at it. And the scientist in this is really trying to do something remarkable. And there is a lot of discussion actually in here about the ancient teachers of science prior to his actually creating the monster. And let us remind everyone that Dr. Frankenstein is indeed the scientist, not the monster which
himself.
People get very confused about because of popular culture, because Frankenstein has become the monster. And so in here, he talks about the ancient teachers of this science promised impossibilities and perform nothing. The modern masters promise very little. They know that metals cannot be transmuted and that the elixir of life is a chimera. But these philosophers, whose hands seem only made to dabble in dirt and their eyes to pore over the microscope or crucible, have indeed performed miracles. And he is trying to perform a scientific miracle, essentially, and talks about that the enticement of science and how fabulous science is to somebody. What he writes is, none but those who have experienced them can conceive of the enticements of science. In other studies, you go as far as others have gone before you, and there is nothing more to know. But in a scientific pursuit, there is a continual food for discovery and wonder. A mind of moderate capacity, which clearly pursues one study, must infallibly arrive at great proficiency in that study. And I, who continually sought the attainment of one object of pursuit and was solely wrapped up in this, improved so rapidly that at the end of 2 years, I made some discoveries in the improvement of some chemical instruments, and which procured me great esteem and admiration at the university, which, of course, what does everyone still want? Admiration at the university.
I mean, there are aspects of this at the deepest level that obviously never change about science, but this is written at a point in time, you know, obviously we knew a lot less, but the whole pursuit of science and the world was really opening up in terms of what we knew, and engineering a really pivotal point in society and in science.
Absolutely. Well,
and that shows you how forward-thinking she was. I mean, we have to remember who wrote this, and her knowledge would have been very limited. And yet she was able to see that based on philosophy, as much as anything else, she can extrapolate a character who can reach for these kinds of things and add in, you know, the science to make it interesting and scary, you know, at least at that time frame. But she's using sort of the philosophy of learning to say, here's what this person could do and where it could lead. And I think that's fascinating for a writer of that time frame.
Absolutely. And one of the things that she also happens in this novel, and again, if you haven't read it, the thing that most struck me, because I, in fact, had never read this before we did it as the townwide read, was that the monster gets to narrate many of the chapters and is talking about the science that created him. And so it's a very interesting, lots of details about how he was created. He talks about talking to the scientist, because he's essentially writing his version of the story, the monster is, and says, it was your journal of the 4 months that preceded my creation. You minutely described in these papers every step you took in the progress of your work. This history was mingled with accounts of domestic occurrences. You doubtless recollect these papers. Here they are. Everything is related in them, which bears reference to my accursed origin. The whole detail of that series of disgusting circumstances which produced it is set in view. The minutest description of my odious and loathsome person is given in language which painted your own horrors and rendered mine indelible. I sickened as I read. But what he's reading about is the scientific process.
I mean, he's reading a scientific lab notebook.
Right, exactly, yeah. Right. Exactly, yeah. Right. So it's very interesting how the science is integrated into the novel.
Very fascinating. All right. We are talking today about Lab Lit, novels that feature scientists as main characters and, of course, sometimes crossing into the science fiction realm. We'd love to hear from you. What's your favorite book about a scientist? You can chime in by calling toll free at 866-999-4626. We do not have email this morning. So if you want to weigh in with your favorite book about a scientist, the phone's the way to do it. Again, 866-999-4626. We're going to take a short break here, and when we come back, we'll have more Lab Lit, and we'll take your calls. This is The Point. I'm Heather Goldstone. We're talking today about Lab Lit, novels that feature scientists as main characters. With me is Jill Erickson, reference librarian at Falmouth Public Library, and Melanie Lowers, book editor at the Cape Cod Times. Now, before the break, we were, of course, talking about Frankenstein, which is what kind of kicked this all off, at least locally, and the mad scientist portrayal that was in that, and also the ups and downs that we've seen over the past century or so in portrayals of scientists. And Melanie, I wanted to go to one book that you brought from kind of mid-century, the mid-20th century, was, I think, another point where we saw a resurgence of this perhaps ill will towards scientists. We had the Manhattan Project, nuclear right. weapons development, a lot of angst about the role of science. But you brought a book that typifies all that, but also talks about or looks into the people that go along with the scientists, not just the not just the scientists themselves.
Well, this is a brand new novel out by Tara Shay Nesbitt. It's called The Wives of Los Alamos, and it's actually getting quite a bit of attention because it does write about a topic that I think most of us don't know anything about. It's brand new, and the author teaches creative writing and literature at the University of Denver, my alma mater, so I went for it immediately. And the book is set in Los Alamos, and basically what happens is that during the war, when these men are gathered up, these scientists are gathered up from all over the United States to work on this project of creating a nuclear weapon, this is the story of their wives and their children who go with them and create a community in which they are the quiet ones in the room, while the science talk is going on, they are hearing all of this and they are providing sort of a backdrop, sort of the ordinary American kind of thing against the backdrop of these super minds that have been brought together at the time for them, huge national security issues. And of course, we know that that went on for quite a while and still does. But this is the first time where I've seen the story sort of say, for those of us who are not scientists but are close to them, what is the experience like? And so the scientists are almost in some ways secondary characters. They're husbands and fathers and sons and that kind of thing, but they are also bringing their science home. They can't help it. They are of a certain type of mind. And so this is an interesting and now becoming a very popular novel in that vein, which I find kind of interesting. We're going to the lab, but we're leaving again and going home, you know, and not staying in the lab. I think that for me, the mid-century person who sort of who really shifted things again, and I think part of this is because of television, that science used to be way far away, locked away somewhere. We didn't
something
have
distant and
distant.
Impersonal. And
we didn't have access to the labs. We didn't know the people. They were hunched over, you know, in popular culture, they're hunched over a lab bench, you know, looking into a microscope with a white coat on.
Right, white coat, big white hair.
Right, the big
old white
hair.
Guys.
They haven't combed it in 20, 30 years because they're too busy, you know, solving the problems of the universe. And then along comes Michael Crichton, who is a doctor, not a scientist per se. But in 1969, he published a book called The Andromeda Strain. And I think that that was a huge turning point for readers and also a huge turning point for science and literature and therefore the power of the scientists in culture and in history. And this was a huge hit. It's hard to underestimate how huge it was. And he followed with many, many others. And I happened to bring Jurassic Park with me because it's one of my favorite stories. And I have no doubt the idea behind Jurassic Park pops up in the news every so often.
Absolutely.
Constantly.
We've got a whole de-extinction movement
in the works
at this point.
Actually, I was just listening about that the other day. And so I brought Jurassic Park with me just as an example. And it's been almost 35 years since it came out, believe it or not. That seems amazing to me. But it features prominently paleontologists, geneticists, and a mathematician who goes on and on about chaos theory. And so when you read this book, yeah, there are children involved and, you know, gruesome and gory parts and things like that. It's a real thriller. But the main protagonists of the story are the people who are trying to solve the issue of what these reanimated creatures will do in a modern setting and how mankind has to reset its own thinking to be safe around these creatures that it has not shared a planet with in many, many millennia. But so I thought that he did a number of these books. He was very prolific. He died in 2008 and put things together like Congo, Sphere, The Terminal Man, which was another one that's very modernistic in its vein. The Lost World. I mean, he went in directions that with his style, because he was a very good writer, and his sense of popular knowledge, we could go with him. And that's a huge change, I think, for readers, is to have science that they can follow and science that they can learn from, not science that's separate. And I think that was a very much of a turning point for readers. And then, of course, I've got science fiction here that's become more like science, less like fiction, as the years have gone on, too, because the things that were only imagined 50 to 75 years ago are now on the table.
Well, and of course, I think this... We've seen this from Frankenstein and onward. Of course, science is pushing the boundaries of what we know. So you're inevitably going to get into a little bit of science fiction realm because you're always trying to imagine the next step.
That's right. Absolutely. And it's interesting. One of the books that we did with the book club was Paul Theroux's The Mosquito Coast. And the argument I had with the book club was they were saying, well, he's not a scientist. Our main protagonist is not a scientist. Why are you having us read this? But in fact, I would make an argument that he is, in fact, an inventor. He invents amazing things, and that he certainly has a scientific nature to him. And he, in fact, of course, again, one of the reasons I picked this book was he mentions Frankenstein in the course of the novel. And he's the father. The basic story is that it's the story of Allie Fox, a Yankee genius, a Maine-born Harvard dropout, a self-taught engineer and inventor, a rejecter of God in the American way and all other sources of bad workmanship, a born counterculturalist and survivalist who nevertheless feels nothing but scorn for those canting new creeds. At the novel's opening, Fox lives in Hatfield, Massachusetts with his patient wife and four children. And to call her patient is beyond, she's a saint. She's not more than or she's insane. And that, of course, one of the things you do get out of this novel is he crazy or is he brilliant? And where do you draw the line? But in the course of the book, he's saying that he's building this creation because they end up traveling. They end up traveling. He decides he hates America so much and he hates the way America is going so much that they end up going to Honduras. He packs the whole family up. He's got these twins and two other boys and puts them onto a ship and they're all going to Honduras because he's convinced that Honduras will be a better place to live than America at the time. So starts to make this village. He's creating these various experiments with heat and ice, and he's very much wants there to be ice in Honduras. And he creates a machine that makes ice. And of course, how long does ice last when you're living in Honduras? Not that long. So he said he was making a monster. "I'm Dr. Frankenstein," he howled through his welder's mask. He called one set of pipes its lungs and another its poop shaft, and two tanks a pair of kidneys. He always spoke of the plant as he. "He needs a gizzard today," or "this will fit straight onto his liver," or "how's this for his gullet?" And he creates this and everything is going, you know, pretty well. But he is essentially a mad scientist. And as a result, things go sort of downhill rather rapidly after he does his first experiments. But he talks about the human body and what it is. And he says, "Take the human body," he said. "That contained all the physics and chemistry we needed to know. The best inventions were based on human anatomy. He himself had two patents on ideas he had plagiarized from the body, his self-sealing tank and his metal muscle. He said there was no better piece of engineering than the ball and socket joint in the human hip. Computer technology was just a clumsy way of making a brain, but the central nervous system was a million times more complicated. Insulation? Look at fatty tissue. You had to study natural things. Anyone who took a good look at an alligator or a jicotee could make an armored vehicle. The natural world showed man what was possible. In a world without birds, there would be no airplanes. Airplanes are just magnified sparrows. They're Crascos with legroom." And so he is very much of a scientific mind, but he also has real issues with God and his family he treats very badly. And what was interesting about the discussion of the book was mostly about what a horrible person he was, even though he was making these incredible inventions. And things do not end particularly well for him in this novel. But I think that it's a very interesting take on what, again, it's a sort of modern mad scientist. It is certainly connected to the Frankenstein model, but he's very much commenting on what's wrong with the model.
Well, and in addition to these books, you know, kind of giving us a portrayal of the scientists, the people doing it, whether it's Frankenstein 100 years ago or talking about essentially de-extinction, bringing back dinosaurs or other extinct animals, or in this case, the field of biomimicry, of engineering based on biological systems. I mean, we're getting it at trends in science. Mm-hmm. Through these books, trends in real science, whether or not they're writing about, you know, in a fiction realm or a fact realm.
Here's another good example. I was very surprised to find this. A book called Strong Motion, a novel by Jonathan Franzen that he published in 1992. It's his second novel, 11 years before The Corrections. And The Corrections is generally where most readers pick up with Jonathan Franzen. So this is unknown Jonathan Franzen. But basically what he's done is it's a family issue. Protagonist Lewis Holland's grandmother is killed by an earthquake, and this is north of Boston, and he ends up falling in love with seismologist Dr. Renee Sitchek, sent to discover the cause. And then there's this whole thing here where they're talking about she's going through paperwork, you know, because she's trying to find the source. She's been brought in to find out why they've had this string of now fatal earthquakes north of Boston. And for those of us who know that there is a fault through Massachusetts.
We have a few small ones here and there.
Right. I experienced it a few times when I was a kid growing up. Pretty strong ones. But anyway, they're both reading this scientific piece about drilling in the Berkshires. And he says, lots of big words here, Lewis said. Actually, a seminal article in its way, Renee, with unseemly possessiveness, kept a hand extended until he gave her back the article. The evidence back then was so flimsy the paper should never have been published, but this is an idea that's still around, that there's this huge ocean of crude oil and natural gas pooling right below the Earth's crust, and that all this fuel is from the primordial gunk that went into making the planet, and that the total reserves of so-called fossil fuels are just a drop in the bucket compared to all this stuff farther down. The Swedish government fairly recently spent $10 million drilling an inconclusive well in this Siljan Basin. The idea is not bad. Not many people take it seriously, though. So then there's this thing from Nature, and she goes on to talk about the drilling, and then she goes down, she says she closed one folder and opened another. The handwriting on the tabs of the folders was as regimented as a draftsman's. February 25th, 1987, she said. Boston Globe. Tremors in Essex County persist. She handed Lewis a photocopied clipping. April 12, 1987. Boston Globe again. Scientists puzzled by Peabody earthquake swarm. She took out a third article. Earthquake Notes, 1988, number 2. The Peabody micro-seisms of January to April 1987 and their tectonic environment. And she goes on and on and on like this. Now, what are we reading in headlines right now? Outbreaks of earthquakes in places where they have not existed near fracking. Right. And so the technology may have changed and the language may have changed, but the basic information has been there for a long time. And so this novel, I think, is a very, very early example of what we're talking about now in the headlines. Is fracking leading to earthquakes in places that don't have faults of their own? Is it creating faults?
And it's also, I mean, it's a fascinating glimpse into the scientific process. I mean, she's got all of the scientific publications as well as the popular, you know, mainstream media publications all lined up and looking at how our knowledge has advanced over time. That's not something you necessarily find in every novel.
No, in fact, here's a whole section on that's here in full, A Theory of Subcrustal Petroleogenesis. And and I'm thinking,
do you think having it in a fiction setting like that makes it more accessible to readers? It's not as intimidating if you don't have to know it because it's part of a fiction setting?
I do, and I think what happens is you have one character who's teaching and one character who's learning. And so the reader becomes with the learning one. And you just naturally fall into the pattern of being willing to read these things. If you read Moby Dick, Moby Dick is a wonderful encyclopedia on whaling and on whales. You can be a cetologist practically after reading Moby Dick. And yet, that's all mixed in with this whole sort of like hodgepodge of millions of other pieces of information and this long plot and these dramatic characters. And yet at the same time, it's like a cetology encyclopedia. So you can get both at the same time and have a lot of fun doing it.
All right. We want to know what your favorite books about scientists are. You can give us a call at 866-999-4626. Paul is on the line from West Tisbury. Paul, what's your favorite book about a scientist?
My favorite book is Aerosmith by Sinclair Lewis. It was published in the 20s. Sinclair Lewis was the author of Babbitt and Main Street, a Pulitzer Prize-winning author and playwright. Aerosmith probably had more effect on young men and women developing an interest in science in the 20s and 30s and 40s. It's a story about a young man who, from a small Midwestern town, who becomes a very well-known microbiologist, but the point is that the science in it is very clear, very accurate, and gives you a really interesting insight not only into the science but the personality of the man and his family. Extraordinary book. It did have a major effect on me and many other of my colleagues.
All right. Well, Paul, thank you so much for calling. If you want to call with your favorite book about a scientist, the number is 866-999-4626. Jill, I see you nodding along here.
Well, Aerosmith is actually one of the books that she mentions in her article. There are three books that she talks about as sort of pre-lab, you know, before the big craze of Lab-Lit. And one of them is Sinclair Lewis's Aerosmith, 1925, C.P. Snow's The Search, 1934, and William Cooper's The Struggles of Albert Woods, 1953. So it's not as if this hasn't existed before, and I'm really glad to hear that caller talk about that novel and how it influenced him. One of the books that I brought along today is, in fact, a children's book. And I think the children's book have a great capacity to influence lives. And I went to our children's librarian and said, can you tell me about one book, you know, that would be a good book that talks about somebody doing science? And what book would that be? And she sort of got tears in her eyes and went over to the shelf and pulled off this book called The Evolution of Calpurnia Tate by Jacqueline Kelly. And she said she'd read it once and it was so good she immediately had to read it again. And it is about an 11-year-old girl, a middle child of seven siblings. All the rest are boys. It's summertime, 1889 in Fentress, Texas. And as they say, hot enough to fry an egg outside. The local newspaper reports that the temperature was 106 degrees in the middle of the street. And after Callie's letter to the editor is published, as she writes, it seemed to me that the temperature in the shade would be a lot more useful to the citizens of our town. Her favorite brother encourages her to spend the summer writing down her scientific observations. And the person that ends up being her companion in this is her grandfather, who ends up giving her a copy of The Origin of Species. And she and her grandfather end up actually finding a new species of plant, but it talks about what it's like to be with her grandfather out in nature looking for things. And he talks about his microscope, and he says, he's coming. Yes, sir, coming. I galloped down the hall into the library with a fishing creel over my shoulder. It was an old wicker one of Granddaddy's with hardly any fishy smell left. It was full of my notebook, collecting jars, a cheese sandwich, a corked bottle of lemonade, and a waxed paper twist of pecans. I thought we'd use the microscope today, he said, securing it in its case and nestling it in its haversack. It's an old one, but the lenses are nicely ground, and it's still in good condition. I expect you have newer ones at school. A microscope was a rare and valuable thing. We had no microscopes at school. I was willing to bet I was looking at the only one between Austin and San Antonio. We don't have any at school, Granddaddy. This gave him pause. Is that so? I don't understand the modern educational system at all.
Okay, so this was written in 1889, but it sounds like it could have been.
It takes place in 1889.
And sounds like it could be
Very modern. And very much of what she experiences is the things that girls are expected to do. And so she's complaining because she has to learn sewing and knitting and smocking, and she wants to be out in the fields looking for scientific things with her grandfather. So a great, sweet novel.
All right, that sounds great. I'm talking with Jill Erickson, reference librarian at Falmouth Public Library, and Melanie Lowers, book editor at the Cape Cod Times. We're talking about Lab Lit, and we want to hear your favorite book with a scientist. Our phone number is 866-999-4626. We're going to take a short break here, and we'll talk more in a few minutes. This is The Point. I'm Heather Goldstone. We're talking today about Lab Lit, novels that portray scientists as major characters. With me is Melanie Lowers, book editor at the Cape Cod Times, and Jill Erickson, reference librarian at Falmouth Public Library. We still have huge piles here on the table that we're not going to get through. But before we get to those, I want to... Margaret is calling from the Woods Hole Library. Good morning, Margaret. What's your recommendation for a book with a scientist as a main character?
One I'm thinking of is quite old, and people probably are very familiar with it. It's Wrinkle in Time by Madeline L'Engle.
I am so glad you brought that up because, of course, as soon as I started trying to think of books that I'd read with scientists in them, I was racking my brain, couldn't actually think of many, and I came to Madeline L'Engle. And not only Wrinkle in Time, where, of course, they've got the mother of the family who's a molecular biologist who now has a lab in her basement trying to cure her son's rare disease. But then Madeline L'Engle wrote a whole bunch of kind of coming-of-age young adult fiction that I worked my way through as a tween about a young woman becoming a marine biologist, which I think must have really stuck with me because I, of course, then went on to become a marine biologist. So, Margaret, thank you so much for bringing up Madeline L'Engle. If you have a favorite book about a scientist, you can give us a call at 866-999-4626. All right, we've got these big piles to get through, and we're running out of time. We will put a list up on our website with more of them, but Jill... Richard Powers.
I do have to just mention Richard Powers because I think he's a brilliant writer. He's a difficult writer. He is not. It is not an easy read. In fact, in reading his newest book, Orfeo, I really had to sort of have a dictionary at the... And part of it is not just the scientific language. It's the music language. He is a musician. He writes beautifully about music. In this particular novel, part of what slows you down is you want to keep stopping and going to listen to the pieces of music he's describing because he describes them so beautifully. But the plot is basically about this retired fellow who's in his 70s, and he has been a music teacher, and he has studied music, but he, in fact, started as a chemist. And he has decided in his age that he's trying to connect the science and the music is basically what he's trying to do. And so he's got this little bio lab going in his house, and he's creating things that he probably shouldn't be creating. What he has to do... And what ends up happening is that his dog dies. He calls 911 because he's so upset about his dog dying. He then hangs up on them. And the next day, two guys from Homeland Security show up at his house because they're wondering what he's done with the dog. Because in this town, you're not supposed to bury dogs in the yard. And in any case, they come back. And when they come back, they discover he has this little bio lab going. And he's experimenting with DNA is basically what he's doing. And they are very nervous about this, because they're from Homeland Security. So, of course, they're nervous about it. And then he tells them, oh, well, you know, the chemistry isn't really any more difficult than learning Arabic. And once he mentions that he was learning Arabic,
he says,
right, suddenly things, they get very suspicious of him. And what ends up happening in this book, or what the entry point is the science and the music, but in fact what ends up happening is they sort of he ends up reviewing his whole life, because he ends up on the run, because when he goes back to his house the next time, it is covered, the hazmat suits are everywhere, and they've taken over his house and they're trying to find out what he was doing. They are convinced he was a terrorist, and they have all these reasons to think he was a terrorist, but of course he was not a terrorist. Beautiful language, though. Wonderful, wonderful novel. Very moving in its own way, particularly, again, about the music. And there is that real draw between scientists, I think, and music. There's something that pulls the two of them together. And his other novel that he wrote, also about science and very similar in a lot of ways to Orfeo, is The Goldbug Variations. And in this, he weaves together genetic coding and knowledge and music and computer programming, the mysteries of language and art history, into this great story about the mysteries of DNA coding. Now, let me tell you, I'm a person who would not normally be very interested in the mysteries of DNA coding. But in this particular novel, not only are there scientists, but it is the best description of a reference librarian I have ever read. There is this fabulous
character. We're crossing into library lit.
Library lit. We move right from lab lit to library lit. And it is so fabulous. And let me just read you a little bit of this paragraph about the librarian, because I have to tell you, the librarian is a very key character in this. And of course, she's trying to get to the bottom of the mystery. And what she writes is, "Mother always insisted I got what I had coming. From birth, I was addicted to questions. When the delivering nurse slapped my rump, instead of howling, I blinked inquisitively. As a child, I pushed the why cycle to breakpoint. At six, I demanded to know why people cried. Mother launched into the authorized version of The Uses of Sorrow. At the end of her extended explanation, it came out that I really wanted the hydromechanics of tear ducts." And this is a brilliant character, and one of the very few novels, may I say, where there's a really vibrant reference librarian. And in fact, even in the new one, in Orfeo, there is a brief mention of another public librarian that the main character ends up getting involved with. But I think that he really does this great job of combining the music and the science.
Well, and also, you've pointed out a few cases where it's not necessarily a credentialed scientist at an academic institution that we're talking about. It's people with a scientific worldview.
That's
conducting
right.
investigations
right.
of the world.
Exactly right. Exactly. And again, sort of on the edge of the mad scientist, but not quite there.
All right, Melanie.
Okay. I think also another important aspect of where you find the science and the scientists in fiction is sort of how is the personality of the scientist portrayed? Not just the work, but the personality of the person. And I found a couple of good examples of that. And the first one is Alan Lightman's Einstein's Dreams. And you were saying that you had interviewed him a couple
weeks ago. We just spoke
with
Alan Lightman a couple of weeks ago.
Yeah. And I mean, this is, I haven't read this yet all the way through, but what I was able to read, I'm totally engaged in it already. It's absolutely beautiful.
He's a beautiful writer.
He's a beautiful writer. And the interesting thing is he is a physicist, but he is also the first professor at MIT with a joint appointment in sciences and humanities. And I think that tells you that there is sort of a joining in some ways going on. And I think to the enrichment both of science and to the humanities and to those who love both disciplines. And as a lover of the humanities, I find it only a value to have science added in and not kept separate. I'm for most of my life growing up, I said to myself, oh, I don't like science. But it's not true. I love science. But I love science put in a certain way to me. That's my necessity.
Well, and Alan Lightman told me when we spoke that this had been since he was a child, that he had loved writing and loved
yes.
science and had always been told he had to choose and essentially refused.
Right. Thank goodness.
Yeah.
Thank goodness. But here's a beautiful part. And they're dated 14 April 1905. Suppose time is a circle bending back on itself. The world repeats itself precisely, endlessly. For the most part, people do not know they will live their lives over. Traders do not know that they will make the same bargain again and again. Politicians do not know that they will shout from the same lectern an infinite number of times in the cycles of time. Parents treasure the first laugh from their child as if they will not hear it again. Lovers making love the first time undress shyly. And then in the next section, which I also found that I really loved, and this is called Interlude, Einstein and Besso walk slowly down Spikergasse in the late afternoon. It is a quiet time of day. Shopkeepers are dropping their awnings and getting out their bicycles. From a second floor window, a mother calls to her daughter to come home and prepare dinner. Einstein has been explaining to his friend Besso why he wants to know time, but he says nothing of his dreams. Soon they will be at Besso's house. Sometimes Einstein stays there through dinner and Mileva has to come get him, towed in their infant. That usually happens when Einstein is possessed with a new project, as he is now, and all through dinner he twitches his leg under the table. Einstein isn't good dinner company. Now, look at the transition there between the scientists working, you know, and you, first you want to know the project, and then you're brought back to the man, the physical man.
I've never thought about Einstein as a father.
No.
Or as dinner company.
No, not at all. Or having a friend and saying, well, I'll tell him some things, but not others. That chapter alone fascinated me. And this...
And I just want to say, Lightman also wrote this fabulous essay in the New York Times about how art and science influence one another and call art the transfigures science. And it's a lovely essay on how differently writers and scientists think from one another, but how you could really learn from, and not just writers, but artists of all kinds think. And he talks about what science can offer art is that most subtle quality of all, the way that scientists think, the way they live in the world, or what one might call the mind of science. Science and art have different ways of thinking, and those differences, when explored and portrayed, can enlarge both activities. And I think that's very true. Really a lovely essay. We'll put a link up to that as well.
Absolutely. We'll include that on the website. All right, Melanie, you've got another one there.
Another beautiful one. Salmon Fishing in the Yemen by Paul Tordai, which was turned into a movie with Ewan McGregor. And I have not seen it, but this gentleman, he and his wife are both scientists, and they both have projects that they're working on. But he's been offered this project of possibly introducing salmon to a river in Yemen as a way to bring tourists. It's an economic development thing, but mostly he's a fisheries guy, and so he's as interested in the fish and the water as he is in any way the economics. And at one part, he and his wife have been talking, and they don't have any children. They're both focused on their work. They actually have desks, you know, practically side by side. And he writes, "I fell into a waking dream and saw the bright sunlight of the Yemen uplands and the glittering pools of water where hen salmon were laying their eggs against the gravel, 800 eggs per pound of body weight, and the cock salmon were injecting milt amongst them. The salmon eggs were fertilized. They hatched into little aylvins. They wiggled about in the clear water and grew into fry, then parr. At each stage of their evolution, the fish became larger and stronger until they had smolted and were ready to make their journey to the sea. If we seeded a wadi in the Yemen with fish from the English River, would those fish head down to the sea in the summer rains once they had grown? Would the smell of the salt water lure them to the Indian Ocean, even if it was the wrong ocean? I rather thought so. And if we trapped them downstream and shipped them in purpose-built tanks back to the North Sea so that they could run to their feeding grounds in Iceland, what then? Would they overwinter there and then head back for their native English River, or would they try and find the Indian Ocean?" And so this is sort of just reverie, you know, sort of the process of, as he puts it, a waking dream, how we solve problems, how we raise questions in what I think is not just necessarily a scientific mind, but probably, you know, given this subject, a scientific mind. It's the reverie that becomes the inquiry, that becomes the problem to be solved, that becomes the science. Mm-hmm. And I think he's beautifully laid that out there in this novel. And there's much more of that type in the book. Very popular novel.
All right, that's Salmon Fishing in the Yemen.
Salmon Fishing in the Yemen, Paul Tordai.
All right.
And I will mention another marine biologist here, The Highest Tide by Jim Lynch, which is a story of a shrimpy 13-year-old with a supersized passion for marine life who comes of age during a summer of discovery on the tidal flats of Puget Sound. And the opening of this is so beautiful. "I learned early on that if you tell people what you see at low tide, they'll think you're exaggerating or lying when you're actually just explaining strange and wonderful things as clearly as you can. Most of the time, I understand what I saw because I couldn't find words powerful enough, but that's the nature of marine life and the inland bays I grew up on. You'd have to be a scientist, a poet, and a comedian to hope to describe it all accurately, and even then, you'd often fall short. The truth is, I sometimes lied about where or when I saw things, but take that little misdirection away, and I saw everything I said I saw, and more. Most people realize the sea covers 2/3 of the planet, but few take the time to understand even a gallon of it." And wow. He ends up, you know, falling in love, and he also gets very involved with this giant squid. He discovers this giant squid, and all of the media comes to his town because he's discovered the giant squid. So he falls in love, becomes a scientist. It's a great story called The Highest Tide by Jim Lynch.
and starts with an explanation basically of all science, not just marine science.
That's right. That's right. And it's a beautifully written novel.
All right. Well, we still have piles of books here. We will put a list on our website of all of these if you are looking for book suggestions. Melanie, really quickly, a few seconds. What's the title of that last one?
It's a story by Connie Willis called At the Rialto, Quantum Physicists Arrive for a Convention in Hollywood. And this proves that it could also be fun. Somebody actually says when they take their clothes out of their suitcase, they had been permanent press all the way from MIT, but they underwent a complete wave function collapse. The moment I opened my suitcase and came out looking like Schrodinger's almost dead cat.
All right. And on that note, that's Melanie Lauer's book editor at the Cape Cod Times, Jill Erickson, reference librarian at the Falmouth Public Library. I'm Heather Goldstone. Thanks for listening.
Amy Vince produces The Point, with assistance from Jenny Junker. The executive producer is Mindy Todd. Music by Benjamin Verdery and William Coulter. The Point is a production of the Cape and Islands NPR stations, a service of WGBH.